Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. Time to go into the old vault, and this time I'm being lashed by tongues of flame.
That's right. This is going to be the first episode of our two-part look at the Ark of the Covenant.
This was a fun pair of episodes. I remember we were exploring some very strange historical hypotheses, trying to explain the myth of the Great Ark that would strike people dead with blasts of fire or lightning. This was a lot of fun, so we hope you enjoyed it. And it originally aired in December of 2018.
And the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer unto Ashdod. When the Philistines took the Ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. And when they of Ashdod arose early on the morrow, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the earth before the Ark of the Lord. And they took Dagon and set him in his place again. And when they arose early on the morrow morning, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off upon the threshold. Only the stump of Dagon was left to him. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor any that come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod unto this day.
But the hand of the Lord was heavy upon them of Ashdod, and he destroyed them and smote them with emerods, even Ashdod and the coast thereof. And when the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel shall not abide with us, for his hand is sore upon us and upon Dagon our God." They sent therefore and gathered all the lords of the Philistines unto them and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" And they answered, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be carried about unto Gath." And they carried the ark of the God of Israel about thither. And it was so that after they had carried it about, the hand of the Lord was against the city with a very great destruction. And he smote the men of the city, both small and great, and they had emerods in their secret parts.
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 Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And if you couldn't guess by that opening, obviously we're going to be talking about the Ark of the Covenant today. Robert, I think it was when I came back from Thanksgiving break that you were like, we're doing the Ark of the Covenant on the show. And I was like, what the heck are you talking about? Now, you know I'm always up for an exploration of some kind of weird ancient artifact or something like that. So we're good to go. But why did you want to talk about the Ark on this show, Robert?
Well, it's like nothing we've gone after before, Joe, obviously. No, the Ark comes down to the Ark has long fascinated me. I grew up watching Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Indiana Jones movie. I had it on VHS, and I would sit there and watch segments of it in slow motion. Pretty much every special effect in the film I would watch in slow motion, from the melting of Nazis to just more practical stuff as well.
And sit your parents down and your grandparents into a frame-by-frame face-melting analysis.
That sort of thing, yeah. It always fascinated me. And then if you're sitting in church, and I grew up attending church, you pick up the Bible and you flip around, you look at you read the interesting passages, and certainly the passages about the Ark of the Covenant are some of the more fascinating. They just resonate with mystery, and you're like, what is this about? And so I feel like throughout my life I have come back to it, and each time I've looked at it with new eyes, and more recently I've been thinking, what are some scientific possible scientific explanations, even if they're a bit fringy in places, regarding the Ark? Surely they exist, and lo and behold, they do.
Well, the way that the Ark connects to a lot of scientific topics is very interesting. Generally, it tends to connect to them in kind of, like you say, fringy, often kind of like pseudo-scientific kind of ways, but gives you a good mysterious jumping-off point to talk about real science. So yeah, we want to talk about the myth today. We want to talk about some weird fringe and pseudoscience beliefs people have had about the Ark and how that connects to weird ideas about ancient technology, to talk about real science and technology potential in the ancient world, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Now, I have to admit, as much as I love the discussion module, our Facebook group that is associated with Stuff to Blow Your Mind, I actually checked in with the Movie Crushers. This is the group associated with Chuck Bryant's Movie Crush podcast, because I was curious what it is like, A, to have never seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, and also what it is like to have seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, but with some sort of underlying understanding, pre-existing understanding of the Ark of the Covenant. Because I can relate to neither of those. Like, the Ark of the Covenant, as it's revealed in Raiders of the Lost Ark, has pretty much always been there in my life.
Essentially, Raiders is a book of the Bible.
In a way, yeah, really. I saw that, and then later on, I learned how to read and came back and learned what the Bible had to say about it.
But, you know, in Sunday school, we just never got the Emirads. I don't know why they left the Emirads out. I would have loved that when I was seven.
Well, we'll get to this, but I think one of the issues, of course, is translation. In some translations, they're referred to as tumors. I think that's where I encountered it the first time, and I was like, whoa, back up. The Ark of the Covenant is giving the enemies of God tumors, and this was post Raiders. But then I was like, oh, well, I'm really hooked now. Like, this is even more, Eldritch horror heaped upon the mystery of the Ark.
It makes you want to imagine an alternate universe in which Raiders of the Lost Ark was not made by Spielberg and Lucas, but was made by David Cronenberg. And so when they open the Ark, it's kind of like the tumor gun from Videodrome.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, again, that's one of the things about the Ark of the Covenant is it's just so weird. And we're going to keep touching in on that weirdness. And we're also going to keep referring to Raiders of the Lost Ark throughout this episode, because this episode, more than anything that we've covered before, gives us just free license to talk about that movie ad nauseum.
Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating stuff just in the original Ark mythology. But the Indiana Jones treatment of the story partially merges it with something kind of like Pandora's box. Like, it becomes just a container of unknown and unutterable mystery, where there isn't quite so much that feeling in the Bible stories, though it is a strange and sacred object of profound power.
Now, two of the big questions that are generally mulled over concerning the Ark, first of all, what was it? And then secondly, where is it now?
Now, we're mostly going to ruminate over the first question because the second is one of those questions that tends to lead to one of two places. Either the fact that it's simply lost to history, likely destroyed in some prior age or hidden away and lost.
Assuming that there was such an
right.
object.
And that's the other possibility is that it simply did not exist.
Yeah.
Or it leads one to various speculative or even downright conspiracy theories involving, you know, the Knights Templars, perhaps.
Right.
Or there's the notion that it's currently hidden out of sight in the Chapel of the Tablet in northern Ethiopia, which is possible, but there's no proof, or that it was taken to heaven, an answer that requires more of a speculative leap than the notion that the Ark, like so many treasures of history, simply failed to survive history.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the main things that we're going to be exploring in this look at the Ark is that the Ark of the Covenant is yet another one of these ancient stories, these objects of ancient myth, which there have been great efforts by modern writers to ground the myth in what we now know about science and technology, mm-hmm. reimagining what the ancients believed to be magic as some kind of lost, powerful science or technology. And we've discussed before some of the risks of technologizing the myth. It's not necessarily always wrong, but it's an impulse that's not it's also not always justified. There's a sort of naive way of reading ancient texts that says, okay, let's take what they say happened basically at face value, but posit a different explanation for it than they would have. And while this can be a fun exercise, I love doing it, I personally enjoy it, we should always remember not to start feeling like this is a necessary and especially not like it's a parsimonious exercise mm-hmm. when in reality – ancient histories of all kinds, religious texts, myths, and so forth, are likely to be full of narratives that are the result of creative imagination and things like exaggeration across time and retellings. In other words, there's no event that you necessarily have to explain because the events described in these ancient stories often just didn't take place.
Right. We can't treat a description of the Ark in the Old Testament as being the same as, say, a fossil evidence or a crater.
Right. Right. We just don't know. I mean, it might be based on something that actually mm-hmm. happened, but we don't know. But if we take the route of saying, well, okay, if these stories are based on something people saw or based on something that actually happened, when we look at history that way, ancient history with a bit of science under the belt, there is this insatiable itch, the retro sci-fi hermeneutic, which I've been looking for a concise name for. And I think I just realized the perfect one for this era of that, which I'm gonna start calling bronze punk.
Yeah,
so you've got
good.
Yeah, you've got steampunk for the Victorian era. You've got Adam Punk for the atomic age. And I think we should have bronze punk as the name for this retroactive technologizing of the time period of classical civilizations in the ancient Near East, including the Hebrew Bible and its contemporary civilizations and texts. So with those important caveats, I think we should begin a bronze punk adventure into the Ark.
Oh, man. Bronze punk does have a lot of opportunity here. It gives us a chance to bring back Talos, the bronze automaton.
Oh, that's a classic example. Yeah. With Talos, I think that'd be bronze punk. I don't want to be too rigid about the time period that applies to either, because a lot of the stuff we're talking about here I think would technically be bridging Bronze Age and Iron Age in the regions that are affected. But all that aside.
Yeah, anything. It doesn't need to stand in the way of Talos battling the Ark of the Covenant, is what I'm saying.
Well, before we get into all these supposed bronze punk explanations of what the Ark might have been if it existed and if some of the stories about it are based on things people saw, we should just explore the myth. Like, what is the story of the Ark and what do the texts say about it?
All right. Yeah. Well, we're talking here about the Aaron Haberet, the Ark of God, the Ark of Testimony, the Ark of the Covenant. Just a few names that are used to describe it here. A gold-plated wooden chest used by the ancient Hebrews to house the two stone tablets of law given to Moses by God. And it was also said to contain a couple of other holy relics, such as Aaron's rod, a magical item used by Moses' brother, as well as a pot of manna, the supernatural foodstuff that fell from the heavens to feed the Israelites in the desert. Now, in addition to being made of gold, the other decorative element that is a signature of the Ark are the two cherubim that are depicted atop it.
Now, I'm not quite sure why this has happened, but in modern English usage, cherubs or cherubim, that has come to mean naked baby angels,
yes.
Like you would see on those cards or the creepy little statues people put on their dressers. But cherubim are not naked, cute baby angels, right?
Right. Even though, if we describe something as being cherubic today, we're describing, it's got, it's like a baby with fat cheeks, or maybe an adult with fat cheeks and kind of a baby's face. But really, it should be a horrifying adjective to heap on something. It should mean that it is an object or personification of just holy wrath.
Right. A classical example would be angel stationed outside the Garden of Eden with a flaming sword to keep people out.
That's right. I mean, that is a cherub, that true cherub. Forget the Renaissance art here. They're kind of like God's supernatural heavies. But as with any sort of mythological creature, you do see a lot of variety in the way they're depicted, ranging indeed from the bestial to the more humanoid. Depictions of the Ark tend to favor a version of winged humanoids. But we could, and perhaps we should, do an entire episode on angels and religious traditions in the future, because there's so much fascinating material there. So we're talking about creatures that would have been first or second circle in the hierarchy of angels. And their descriptions include or tend to include the form of a lion, the form of a man, the form of an eagle, or any hybrid of these forms.
I've actually seen it described that they sometimes are represented as having four faces.
Yes.
And the four faces would include the lion to represent the beasts of the wild, the man to represent the world of humans. I think an oxen face to represent the world of domesticated animals, and then an eagle face to represent the world of birds, which I guess are somehow different than wild animals.
Yeah, these depictions of the cherubs often look kind of like emblems, right, with like folds of multiple wings and haloed heads of these creatures and a human poking out. Now, according to Carol Rose, a folklorist who I frequently cite on the show, in her book Spirits, Fairies, Leprechauns, and Goblins, an Encyclopedia, Hebrew religious writings state that images of cherubim guarded the Ark of the Covenant as well as Solomon's Temple, and they're divine messengers, attending spirits, and disseminators of knowledge. Now, it's possible, Rose points out, that cherubim are derived from the Assyrian Lamassu or Sidu. And these were the female and male, respectively, benevolent demons in ancient Assyria and Babylon. They would have protected palaces and temples, and they're often depicted as winged bulls or lions with human heads. And they mostly remained invisible and were assigned in the manner of guardian angels to protect an individual human from the evil Utuku.
There are some amazing carvings of these in the Met, in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I believe from the palace of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal II, or maybe not the palace, but I think commissioned by that king. And they are fearsome and wonderful to behold.
Yes, they are. And to come back to Raiders of the Lost Ark, these are, of course, presumably the entities we see flying around after the Nazis open the Ark of the Covenant at the end of the film.
Oh, the cherubim?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, because at first they look like women, sort of beautiful ghost women. And then, of course, the face changes and it becomes this kind of snarling skeletal lion type face. And then, of course, it's death for all who view the Ark.
Now, for an artifact that has come to be imbued with so much mystery retrospectively, the Bible actually does just straightforwardly explain how to build the Ark. It's like minute specifications on what you're supposed to do to make one.
Yeah, it also it almost makes you wonder, like, what's the big deal about losing it? Because clearly you have a strict set of instructions on how to build another one.
Mm-hmm. Like, well, I mean, I think there were just like magical beliefs about the sacredness of what it contained.
Oh, well, yes, certainly. Yeah. But that ultimately is the thing, right? The Ark is a container, fancy container, perhaps even a holy container if you're approaching with that worldview, but just a container for otherwise holy relics.
That is one thing that I think makes it very fascinating and kind of unique. And there are probably some other great artifacts like this, but fascinating in that it is this artifact with all this significance, but it is essentially just a vessel for other things. It's a container. It's not a statue.
Well, should we read the instructions from Exodus 25 in case anyone wants to build along as we do the podcast?
Let's build it.
All right. Get your cubit ruler ready.
And they shall make an ark of shittim wood. 2 cubits and a half shall be the length thereof, and 1 cubit and a half the breadth thereof, and 1 cubit and a half the height thereof. And thou shalt overlay it with pure gold, within and without,
shalt thou overlay it, and shalt make upon it a crown of gold round about, and thou shalt cast four rings of gold for it, and put them in the four corners thereof, and two rings shall be in the one side of it, and two rings in the other side of it, and thou shalt make staves of shittim wood, and overlay them with gold, and thou shalt put the staves into the rings by the sides of the ark, that the ark may be borne with them. The staves shall be in the rings of the ark, they shall not be taken from it.
Now, I want to jump in here and say that this is exactly the kind of description of the ark that is disappointing when you're a child.
Yeah.
And you've seen Raiders and then you want to read about it in the Bible,
uh-huh.
and you just find this kind of boring description of how to build one.
Oh, there are better stories. We got the Imarods. We're going to get to some more later.
Well, this description is about to get a lot more interesting and certainly mm-hmm. will tie into some stuff we're going to discuss later. And thou shalt put into the ark the testimony which I shall give thee. And thou shalt make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2 cubits and a half shall be the length thereof, and 1.5 cubits the breadth thereof. And thou shalt make 2 cherubims of gold, of beaten work shalt thou make them in the 2 ends of the mercy seat. And make 1 cherub on the one end, and the other cherub on the other end, even of the mercy seat shall ye make the cherubims on the 2 ends thereof. So in other words, make the two cherubs face each other on the ends of the mercy seat, but leave a space because that space is important.
Okay.
Anyway, it continues. And the cherubims shall stretch forth their wings on high, covering the mercy seat with their wings, and their faces shall look one to another. Toward the mercy seat shall the faces of the cherubims be. And thou shalt put the mercy seat above upon the ark, and in the ark thou shalt put the testimony that I shall give thee. And there I will meet with thee, and I will commune with thee from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubims, which are upon the ark of the testimony, of all things which I will give thee in commandment unto the children of Israel.
Okay, so this thing is a container, as we've been saying, but mm-hmm. it's also a chair. And it's a chair for God himself.
Right. The idea is that mercy seat is where God is going to manifest, it sounds, from the instructions. Like there is mm-hmm. going to be a presence of the Lord there. And Moses and perhaps some other priests, whoever is in charge, whoever is authorized to do so, will actually commune with God. It is, in the words of Belloc, a radio for speaking to God, a transmitter.
But it's really more like a video phone than just a transmitter, right?
Yeah, it's like FaceTime with God. On that note, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll discuss the story of the Ark, because that, too, will be important as we get into some of these scientific ideas regarding the Ark. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
All right, we're back.
All right, so if the Ark was actually built, about when do we think that would have happened?
It would have been about 3,000 years ago.
Now, we've seen the instructions in the Bible where they believed God had sent his people, the detailed plans on how to make the Ark. But what do they do with it once they've got it?
Well, after they've built it, they carry it around with them and they use it as the central part of their religious observations. I mean, it's essentially a mobile altar piece, right? I mean, it's a temple that you can pick up and move. And so think back again to that part about the mercy seat. This is the point from which God speaks to the children of Israel. And if Raiders is any indication, it's also from whence he sends out his smiting laser beams of holy Nazi-frying death. Mm-hmm. Now, the wording here is interesting because it is the, and I'm possibly butchering this, of course, but the ha-kaparet and kafer, that's K-A-P-H-A-R, means to cover, but kapareth means a thing of wiping out or cleansing. Mm. So they carried it before them when during the Exodus, and it was said to clear impediments and poisonous animals in their path. And it was even said to stop the flow of the River Jordan so that they could cross into the Promised Land.
But it was also conceived of as a kind of a magical weapon of war, right?
Yeah, they marched with it at the Siege of Jericho. Of course, they were blowing those trumpets, but still the Ark was there. And as they're blowing those trumpets, eventually the walls come tumbling down. But then in 597 and 596 BCE, the Babylonian Empire conquered the Israelites, and the Ark was supposedly taken from the temple in Jerusalem. And from there, it vanishes from history.
So if it did indeed exist as to some degree as the stories are told, this is where it stops. We don't know what happens after this.
Right. This is where it becomes the lost ark.
Now, as with any Bible artifact of any significance, I would bet that there are some people out there who claim to have found it.
Yes. And but before we touch on those, I do want to point out just a wonderful fragment of a quote here. Came to us from National Geographic Society fellow Fred Hibbert. He told the website, National Geographic, that it's not really something that you can go after. You can't really search for the Ark because the Ark exists at, quote, the crossroads between myth and reality.
Yeah.
And I think that's essential to keep in mind for the entirety of this episode and the next.
Well, I would say, for example, I think the Ark probably has a better chance of being in some way based on a real historical artifact than something like Noah's Ark.
Right.
But people constantly go looking for Noah's Ark, and every time they go looking, they find it. You know, there's, well, here's some wood on a mountain in Turkey. Here it is.
Right. And likewise, the Ark is essentially just wood and gold and is even less of a feat to build. Like, we have the instructions. You could, if you had the materials, you could build one today. Mm-hmm. So even if we were to uncover an Ark candidate, it's not really possible to tell, though, if you have the Ark of the Covenant.
Right.
I mean,
yeah, there could probably be multiple Arks out there saying that they're the Ark.
Yeah, I mean, there have been cases where archaeologists have found something that is like an Ark, a box that has perhaps excited a few people here and there, but ultimately, it doesn't pan out.
I mean, I suppose if you had a strong candidate, you could do carbon dating on the relic, perhaps the wood, especially if there are any remnants of the wood remaining.
To at least know if it's old enough.
Yeah, to know if it's old enough. But again, it could just be another box from that time period. That being said, some of the possible final resting places for the Ark include, as I already alluded to, St. Mary of Zion Cathedral in Aksum, Ethiopia, under the care of the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church, and more specifically, under the care of a single caretaker who alone gets to see the Ark. Mm-hmm. Naturally, that means no one gets to verify what they actually have or don't have, much less study it. Some claim that it was hidden beneath the first temple in Jerusalem before the Babylonians destroyed it in 586 BCE, but this can't be verified either because that means it would be somewhere beneath the Dome of the Rock Shrine, which of course is a holy site in Islam. Now, there's another claim mentioned in that Nat Geo article that I cited earlier that it was buried beneath a hill, and not just any hill, but the very hill that would later be known as Golgotha, the place of the skull.
Right, which is the place where it is said that Jesus was crucified.
Right, and according to this story, when he's crucified, his blood like drains down into the hill and eventually to the ark itself buried beneath him.
Mm-hmm.
And this relates to a quote-unquote find of amateur adventurer Ron Wyatt, who lived 1933 through 1999, who claimed to have found, among other things, Noah's Ark, the Ark of the Covenant, the Tower of Babel, the graves of Noah and his wife, as well as the blood of Christ itself. Needless to say, one should take his account with all the salt that Wyatt claimed to have also discovered at the ruins of Sodom.
Uh-huh.
Not a true archaeologist.
Now, this guy is not unique in essentially being somebody who is an apologist for their religion who goes out. I mean, I mainly know of this within Christian, you know, like somebody who's basically a Christian apologist, a defender of the faith who goes out seeking artifacts. That has always struck me as a kind of odd thing to want to do. I guess I get it on the level of these are people who are trying to prove that the Bible is literally true and everything, all the stories in it literally happened on Earth a certain number of years ago. But it seems like kind of a profaning of the orientation toward their myths if they're going out and saying like, I'm going to find the bones of this person who's the, you know, in the stories that I believe, or I'm going to find the wood left over from the boat.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can approach it from a few different points of view. I mean, the way I always approach it is that the deep mythology of a given faith need not be factual to have power, and therefore there's no reason to go and try and find fragments of it or expect them to be there. You could, I guess, approach it as someone who needs to find those items because that again supports their religion, perhaps erases doubt. If only I could find a piece of the Ark, then I'd know it was real and I can silence these doubts. The other way of looking at it, of course, is someone who has no doubts whatsoever and they're like, hey, the Ark was obviously real.
Uh-huh. I got to prove it to everybody else.
Yeah, I need to prove it to everybody else. Or I just want to find it. It's out there somewhere. Why has nobody found it? I'm going to be the one to do it. And to your point, if you go into these regions, there is just so much history that especially somebody who's just bumbling around and they don't really know what they're doing, they're going to find something that they can pass off, they can believe in.
I don't know. They end up being kind of like the villains in all the Indiana Jones movies who want to possess some powerful, mysterious ancient artifact, but they want to possess it for some earthly purpose. Like, you know, then I can show everybody this thing or something. It's sort of the moral of Raiders of the Lost Ark at the end that Indy loses his sort of profane curiosity, and he realizes I can just let this thing be sacred and not have to look inside and not have to want to own it and control it and show the world.
Yeah, I think that's a solid read on Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, while we're talking about Raiders, let's go ahead and discuss a few of the details about it. Because I'm assuming most people have seen Raiders, but I know there are some individuals out there who just haven't seen the film yet. And I certainly encourage everyone to see it because it is a damn near perfect motion picture.
Is there a better action adventure movie?
I can't think of one. I mean, you could say Star Wars, right? You could point to other
maybe
big
Seven
films.
Samurai,
huh? Yeah, things of that nature. But I mean, it's such a tentpole film in terms of like big summer action films. It is the film that so many other motion pictures have tried to be. This, of course, was a film that came out in 1981, directed by Steven Spielberg, screenplay by Lawrence Kasdan, story by George Lucas and Philip Kaufman. Philip Kaufman, by the way, is the person who reportedly brought up the idea of using the Ark in the story. Mm-hmm. And he was also the grandson of German Jewish immigrants to the U.S. Spielberg's parental grandparents were Jewish Ukrainians. One would assume that that this played into the use of the Ark in the film, but also some of these themes regarding the struggle of the Jewish people against oppression.
Yeah, well, one of the unspoken subtexts to the film, I think, is that ultimately the Ark ends up fulfilling its destiny as the weapon that protects the Jewish people. In the end, it's destroying Nazis.
Right, and it's recreating a tale that we'll touch on in a bit, the idea that the Ark is stolen by an enemy force and then uses its power against that enemy force.
Yeah, it's sort of a retelling of the Imrod story almost.
Yeah. I should also point out that John Williams did the score for the film, and I'm kind of over John Williams scores for the most part.
I don't know what you're talking about, dude. How can you not love John Williams?
Well, the thing is, in rewatching portions of this film for this episode, I have to give him all the credit in the world because that the scene when they finally open the Ark and the Ark unleashes its wrath upon the Nazis, the music is perfect in that. It just really adds to the sense of just holy mystery that is unfolding there.
Take any movie with the John Williams score and take the score out, replace it with something else. You wouldn't have half the movie.
But what if it was Tangerine Dream? Then I can only imagine it might be just a little better. Maybe.
Well, I love Tangerine Dream too, but you're wrong about this one.
Well, maybe so. Now, key scenes in the film for our purposes, because there's a lot of stuff in there that is, of course, added on and historically inaccurate, certainly. Uh-huh. But there are a few key scenes that match up with a lot of the stuff we're talking about here today. There's a scene in which the Ark burns the swastika off of the crate containing the Ark. And then, of course, there's that fabulous scene at the end where the Nazis open the Ark and those cherubim emerge. And then you also have the burning light of God finally emerging as well and just eradicating everybody that has their eyes open.
And the idea of a fire that burns people emerging from the Ark is absolutely biblical. And Yes. We'll explore more of those stories later on.
Now, a side question that I saw come up on the internet, does Indy actually impact the situation with the Ark and the Nazis at all? Because outside of saving Marion's life, Marion, the romantic interest, does he accomplish anything?
No, and I think that's the genius of it. Mm-hmm. The movie ends with Indy. It's an action movie that doesn't end with a fist fight. Right. There's no fight of any kind at the end. The hero of the movie at the end is completely powerless, and his victory at the end is assuming a posture of humility in the presence of the sacred.
Yeah, totally. Because to remind everybody, at the end, he and Marion are tied up.
Yeah.
The Nazis have the Ark, and Belloc is opening it in full regalia. In fact, wearing some version of the vestments that are described alongside the instructions for the construction of the Ark.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Ark just murders all of the bad guys.
Yeah.
And Harrison Ford is left to pick up the pieces.
Okay. We can't just fully turn this into a movie crush episode. No. We've got to get back to – so we should probably get into exploring some of the weird scientific tangents people have gotten into on the subject of the Ark. And one of them that you can clearly – look at is the idea of the Imrods and what happened with the Ark in the presence of the Philistines, if you assume this story is based on any kind of historical memory or even an exaggerated version of something that people remembered.
Right. Yeah, because this is getting to one of my favorite things about the Ark, the idea that it brings plague and or madness to those who should not possess it, mm-hmm. that it is a dangerous artifact.
So should we explore the idea of the Ark as a sort of bioweapon?
Yeah, let's talk about the Ark as plague bearer. I just want to remind everybody that previous passage that we read, and it was so that after they had carried it about, the hand of the Lord was against the city with a very great destruction, and he smote the men of the city, both small and great, and they had Imrods in their secret parts.
Now, let's talk about those Imrods.
So Those emerods are often interpreted as hemorrhoids.
Okay. There seems to be a cognate issue there.
And a lot seems to have been written about them over the years, in part because it seems like anytime you have a hemorrhoid paper.
Oh, God, yes.
And there are a lot of hemorrhoid papers out there. The doctors writing them often like to throw in a little bit of biblical flavor at the beginning.
Yes.
You know?
How many times has this story been cited in the International Journal of Hemorrhoid Research?
Right at the very beginning of any paper, because you're ultimately just going to talk about swollen veins in the lower part of the rectum and anus.
Now,
but if you can make it a little magical right at the start, you're going to hook readers.
Right. So for people who don't actually know, can you just briefly explain what a hemorrhoid is?
Yeah, it is swollen veins in the lower part of the rectum and anus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yeah, the basic. I mean, you can get more detailed in describing what causes them and, of course, the treatments that are necessary. But it's been a problem for a long time. Obviously, something that may have been described here in the Bible and just throughout human history, people have had to deal with hemorrhoids.
Now, if the story actually does mean that the Philistines got hemorrhoids, I know it's been translated in other ways, but if it did mean that, would the story be best interpreted as something that's supposed to be humorous? Is it like a joke on the Philistines?
This comes down... Oh, man, you kind of end up asking a big question about humor there, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't think hemorrhoids are ever humorous to the individual that has them.
Right.
But clearly we have a lot of jokes about hemorrhoids.
It's really funny when your enemies get one.
I guess. I mean, it's kind of an insulting curse from a powerful God figure, right?
Right.
It's not just like causing them to go blind or something. It's giving them this annoying health problem. And then there's this other part to it as well. So the Philistines suffer these after they steal it, and they locked it up in the Temple of Dagon, and we see the statue of Dagon fall over multiple times. Mm-hmm. And the Ark, of course, not only mutilated their god's statue, it also caused these emerods, as well as a plague of rampaging mice.
Hmm.
The emerods, again, are also sometimes referred to as tumors. So a lot of people have looked at these examples and tried to figure out, well, what could possibly be going on here? Because if these emerods, be they hemorrhoids or some sort of a tumor, well, that's a symptom. That's something we can look to, that we can analyze via modern medicine. And then maybe we can look to some of these other elements and try and piece something together as well.
Now, just to be clear, once again, we mentioned this earlier, but we don't have direct evidence that this story actually happened. We don't know that this is based on something that people remembered, but it could be. It could be based on some kind of historical event.
Right. And likewise, a lot of work has been done looking at, okay, we had emerods and we had mice. What's the connection there?
Yeah.
When in reality, you could have two separate stories that end up being combined into a story that has emerods and mice.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, a number of people have written about this. Two of the earlier ones were 19th century historians Gaston Maspero and Archibald Henry Sace, who summarized that, quote, "The Philistine soothsayer, being consulted at the end of 7 months, ordered that the solemn sacrifices should be offered up and the ark restored to its rightful worshippers, accompanied by expiatory offerings of 5 gold mice and 5 gold tumors, one for each of the repentant cities."
Hmm.
So they're not only saying, here, take your ark back because it is causing mice to be everywhere and has given us some weird growths. They're saying, here it is back, but also here are some golden mice and some golden hemorrhoids or tumors or something to sort of as payment or perhaps warning to whoever gets the ark next.
Now, I don't want to get too far ahead of things here, but I can't help but notice if you've got mice and you've got tumors or lumps of some kind, I'm going to start thinking about bubonic plague.
That's right, because bubonic plague does result in buboes, which are swellings of the lymph nodes.
So that could sort of be classed as something like a tumor. You get a lump under your skin.
Right. And if you want to do a Google search, you can find images of these swellings. And indeed, they look kind of like lumpy tumor-like growths. Frank R. Freeman, in a 2005 Royal Society of Medicine article, highlighted some other writings on the topic, including a 2000 argument by J.P. Griffin that it was, in fact, plague that was afflicting the Philistines here.
But then one WMS Russell insisted that the tumors were hemorrhoids due to dysentery and that, quote, the rat carrier of the plague wasn't in the region at the time of the described events. But that, quote, since then, advances in archaeology have shifted the weight of evidence towards Griffin. Moreover, the emeralds of the King James Bible appear in all modern translations as tumors.
So if you're just really trying to make it work as hemorrhoids, you're probably out of luck.
Right. It seems like tumors are a more likely interpretation. And that leads a number of people to say, well, maybe it was bubonic plague. Here's another quote from Freeman. Recent archaeological evidence has caused a rethinking of plague in the ancient Near East. Fossilized remains of the plague flea have been found in large numbers in Amarna, Egypt, and since Amarna was occupied for only a few years, we can date this contact between human beings and plague fleas accurately to about 1350 BCE, which is before the events described in the Book of Samuel. Moreover, archaeological studies in the Nile Valley indicate that R. ratus was introduced at this time, probably via ships from India. Evidence of bubonic plague has not been seen in Egyptian mummies, but all the vectors were in place.
Okay, so this is saying, based on some evidence we have, the historical setting is there. Like, you could imagine that there could be bubonic plague at the right time, in the right place, for this to be what is described in the story about the Ark and the Philistines.
Right. That being said, I don't think anybody's arguing that the Ark was full of plague-infested mice.
Right.
This would just be a situation where the soothsayers made sort of a connection between plague mice and the illness, but instead of connecting those two things together, they just assumed they were both curses of the Ark.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a minute, I do want to come back and discuss the possibility of bio warfare and germ warfare in the ancient world.
Yes. Now, before we get to that, I do want to also mention that one Dr. Otto Neustadter in 1940 considered that the swellings described here might possibly be due to syphilitic infection, which means that the Philistines would have contracted syphilis from the Ark of the Covenant. Or again, that an outbreak of syphilis lined up with the presence of the Ark or was attributed to the presence of the Ark in some fashion.
Is there anything that syphilis doesn't explain?
But, I mean, yeah, if we go back to our earlier discussions of syphilis on this podcast, it seems like you can pretty much describe just about everything. The only thing is you probably get into an argument about when syphilis would have impacted a given region.
No, by that, I didn't mean that syphilis is a good explanation for everything. I just meant that people have tried it on everything.
It's, you know, it's been a powerful force in human history, for sure.
Every historical event has a syphilis hypothesis. As will come up repeatedly in this episode, it's not necessary to invoke bronze punk biowarfare explanations to justify legends of the Ark, but it is certainly, I think, plausible that forms of biological warfare were practiced in the ancient world, that who knows, that the ancient Hebrews or any of the other peoples of the time period could have figured out how to do germ warfare and could have used it. And in fact, we have some pretty interesting evidence that it did actually happen, at least in one case, in the second millennium BCE.
That's right. We're talking about the Hittites of Asia Minor going back to, what, 1500 BCE?
Yeah, around then. So I think the 14th century BCE. So there was an epidemic at the time in the 14th century BCE known to historians as the Hittite Plague that spread throughout the Middle East. And historical records of this pestilence appear in correspondence stele to the Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten from around 1335 BCE. And they say that there's a horrible plague that spread throughout the land. It's affecting some Phoenician cities, and there was a fear that it was being spread by donkeys, which led to them barring people from infected cities from coming into other cities and from preventing donkeys from being used in traveling caravans. And so there is a paper I wanted to talk about published in Medical Hypotheses in 2007 by a microbiologist named Ciro Igino Trevisanato. called The Hittite Plague, An Epidemic of Tularemia and the First Record of Biological Warfare. And this is a really interesting hypothesis. So Trevisano believes that the evidence indicates that the Hittite Plague was in fact an epidemic of tularemia, which is a bacterial infection caused by the bacterium Francisella tularensis. Tularemia can spread between animals and humans, so it's a potentially zoonotic infection, and it can spread via several routes, including tick bites and by just direct contact or inhalation of infected aerosols. It has different symptoms depending on the route of transmission, including high fever and ulcers and swelling of the lymph glands. And the pneumonic version of this infection leads to a cough, chest pain, difficulty breathing, and can definitely be deadly. Tularemia is actually often known to kill off large numbers of rabbits, which has led to it being commonly known as rabbit fever. And especially without modern medical intervention, primarily antibiotics, it can be fatal to humans. So it is a deadly, dangerous disease. Trevisanato says that after the outbreak of this plague hit the Phoenician city of Cymyra, the Hittites, also known as the Neshites, attacked the area and looted it. So you've got the city weakened by disease. The Hittites say, hey, some free stuff. So they run in, they attack the city, and they loot it, taking along livestock among the many spoils of war. But soon after they returned, the Hittite raiders were hit with an outbreak of disease that Trevisanato also thinks was tularemia. And this would make sense because they brought the livestock. The animal hosts were arcs, if you will, for the bacteria. Then, while the Hittites were weakened with this epidemic, another people known as the Arzawans attacked them. Then Trevisanato writes that there are historical records that indicate strange incidents in when like wandering rams appeared in Arzawa. And the Arzawans, of course, wouldn't pass up free livestock, so they incorporated these rams into their flocks. But then they were hit with the disease, probably tularemia. And Trevisanato also mentions a story that there was this Arzawan leader called Uhazidus who was struck by a divine thunderbolt in the knee, disabling him. Quote, a ruler infected with the plague and symptoms thereof being observed in the knees or in a region euphemistically and or puritanically described as the knees fit the metaphor.
Oh, this is the idea where like if an individual is wounded in the groin, they describe it as the knee instead.
Or like the foot. Often in the Bible, the use of the word foot is clearly a euphemism for the genitals.
Okay.
So here's Trevisanato's hypothesis. It's that the Hittites, who had experience with this epidemic, deliberately planted disease-carrying rams among their enemies in order to deliberately spread the rabbit fever, the tularemia, and weaken those enemies. And if that's true, it seems like it worked. The Arzawans were unable to defeat the Hittites after the fever hit them. And we've got historical records that the Hittite king wished plague upon the Arzawans and that there was this Hittite scapegoat ritual in which a ram and a female attendant were sent out on the road spreading disease where they went.
Oh, wow.
So we don't have direct evidence that the Hittites knew exactly what they were doing, you know, that they knew they were spreading disease or that they understood how the spread of disease was happening. So while the evidence for this is very interesting, I would not say it's a proven case of germ warfare and that it doesn't seem like this has become accepted theory about what happened in this case, but it does seem like a very promising hypothesis. But despite not having a germ theory of disease, I think it's certainly feasible that ancient peoples could work out basic principles of epidemic transmission, such as that infected or maybe cursed animals would spread the disease to people they came in contact with. And using this basic knowledge, it's possible that ancient peoples could have deliberately spread diseases among their enemies. And it's clear that later armies with not much more scientific understanding than the ancient peoples had did this.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, two of them, the most probably famous examples of this would be throwing dead things, be they animals or soldiers, over the walls into a besieged city or throwing that kind of stuff down a well to try and destroy an enemy's drinking water.
Yeah. So I just wanted to mention a few examples that are cited in a paper called The History of Biological Warfare by Friedrich Frischknecht. And these would all be before the germ theory of disease, but he mentions that in 11
755, Emperor Barbarossa poisons water wells with human bodies in Italy. In 1346, the Mongols catapulted bodies of plague victims over the city walls of Kaffa in the Crimean Peninsula. And in 1495, the Spanish mixed wine with blood of leprosy patients to sell to their French enemies in Naples.
That's quite a cocktail.
So while I would absolutely say that we do not need to resort to explanations like this to explain the origins of these stories, at the same time, I think it's fascinating and highly plausible that there could have been cases where ancient peoples used biological or germ-based weapons to hurt their enemies. Like, you can imagine a vessel or a container as some kind of biological Trojan horse, tricking enemies into taking home some disease vector with them. What if you get people to steal your ark and it's actually a box full of rabbit corpses covered in tularemia ticks?
Yeah, I would have assumed they'd look inside it before they take it home. I mean, that just seems like that's just common sense.
Well, maybe you make a crafty one with like some hidden, you know, containers on the
compartments.
Stuff on the, yeah, hidden compartments with grates for the ticks to get out. You can get really creative with this.
So there are no instructions about that, though, in the biblical account.
It's true. There are not. But I'm not saying that this actually happened and explains the story. I don't think you need to go there.
All right. We're going to take one more break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about radiation and the idea of the ark being indeed a radio for talking to God.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
All right, we're back. So I mentioned earlier, you know, the influence of fiction on our considerations of the Ark. And I definitely remember being, I guess this was like junior high,
reading Stephen King's The Stand, and then also looking around in the Bible and thinking about the Ark of the Covenant.
Okay.
There's, of course, this wonderful sequence throughout the later portions of Stephen King's The Stand in which, what was his name? Do you remember this character?
Which character?
The character who's dragging the atomic bomb across the
Trash
desert.
Can Man.
Trash Can Man, yes.
Donald Merwin Elbert.
Ah, that's good. Do you remember his whole name?
Yeah.
I just remember him just being like the melty bomb guy.
Yes.
Because he's just ravaged by radiation sickness and mutation. He's just, his skin's basically dripping off his body as he drags this bomb into the final scene of the entire book.
Well, based on a kind of atomic age monster movie understanding of how radioactivity works, you could certainly imagine somebody looking at the story of, they took this thing killed people, and sometime at one point people took it and they got tumors. This must be radioactive. Maybe it's a plutonium bomb.
Yeah, it sounds like something right out of a Fallout game or a Planet of the Apes movie, right?
Yeah.
But of course, we can't really seriously consider any explanation that involves an ancient atomic weapon.
No.
There's just no explanation for why that would have occurred.
Right. I think the use of germ warfare among the ancients, even though they might not have had a germ theory of disease, I do think it's plausible given what they could have figured out just based on experience. It is not plausible at all that they – I mean, not even close that they came up with any kind of highly radioactive – materials.
Right. Because, of course, the other side of the equation is, hey, we have naturally occurring radioactive materials. Perhaps they just dug that stuff up and stuffed the Ark full of it. Because, I mean, certainly you have sites like Ramsar, Iran, that have a lot of naturally occurring radioactive materials there. But they still don't produce anything near the high-level doses required to cause radiation sickness.
Yeah. Digging uranium out of the ground even, it's not going to be anything like that. Mm-hmm. The highly radioactive elements we would find in like nuclear reactor fuel or nuclear weapons exist only in extremely tiny trace amounts naturally. And to produce significant amounts of something like uranium-235 or plutonium-239, you have to subject naturally occurring rocks containing mostly more stable elements like uranium-238 to some kind of process, right? You've got to like bombard it with neutrons in a reactor, or you've got to centrifuge it to separate out the more dangerous U-235. The greatest natural terrestrial source of human exposure to ionizing radiation seems to be radon gas. Radon is one of the radioactive decay products of uranium, along with other elements like radium and thorium. And I just haven't found any evidence of a natural terrestrial radiation source strong enough to cause acute or noticeable radiation poisoning within a short span of time. Exposure to natural terrestrial radiation sources can be dangerous, for example, radon gas, but this is more because it tends to increase something like your risk of cancer over long periods of time. For example, radon gas is believed to be the number one cause of lung cancer among non-smokers. And the number two cause of lung cancer overall. So even the most potent natural radiation sources, they're not going to do anything to you that you could detect, I think, without modern science. So I find it extremely unlikely that anybody in the ancient world could have an acutely lethal radiation source in a box. I think we got to rule that one out.
Take that, junior high Robert Lamb.
I'm sorry, dude. I'm
no,
sorry.
No. He had it coming.
Well, now you made me feel like a jerk.
No. This is not at all. I mean, this was something I was curious about when I was in junior high. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you get to look into it and realize, that didn't really pan out.
Now, I do want to mention something that I think we should come back and explore in a future episode, which is the idea of natural nuclear reactors. I don't believe any exist today, but there is evidence that billions of years ago, long ago in Earth's history, when the elements in Earth's crust were younger, there were some natural fission reactions that were sustained within rocks in rock formations within the Earth's crust. Like I know at least one site in Western Africa, there are these 2 billion year old natural fission reactors that we found all this evidence of, that there was essentially a nuclear fission reactor happening naturally under Earth's crust. And that's led to even these really strange hypotheses, like alternative hypotheses for the origin of the moon, which say that it was the result of a natural fission reaction explosion in Earth's crust. billions of years ago, which I know that is not a favored hypothesis, but it has been put forward.
I believe this was also the underlying science in the more recent American Godzilla film.
Oh, wait, what?
Yeah, I believe so. Like, the idea was that Godzilla is this ancient organism from back when you had naturally occurring high levels of radiation on Earth, and that they ate radiation.
Okay.
And that's their whole reason for being gigantic radiation-spewing monsters.
Nice. I don't think they get into – the one I've seen recently is Shin Godzilla, which is – absolutely amazing, but they don't really explore the origin, do they?
I don't think they do. They're hyper concerned with the present.
Yes.
How do we react to this? What do we have legal authority to do?
Where to hold the meeting?
Yeah, that sort of thing. So those are both really fun movies in their own right. So at this point, let's come back to again that fabulous quote from Belloc in Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's a transmitter, a radio for speaking to God.
Okay.
That's a little more Peter Lorre, but you get the idea.
The more earthly indie says, you want to talk to God, we'll go see him together right now.
Yeah, it's a fun moment in the film. But the idea is central to the whole purpose of the Ark, as we've discussed already. It's described as not only a place to house sacred relics, but as a focus of ritual, an altar of sorts, a mobile altar. God manifests upon the mercy seat and speaks to the priests, instructing the priests of God's will.
Okay, so if this is how they believed the Ark to function in their worship— what are the ways you could interpret this?
Well, I think the most likely explanation of all would be that it just would simply serve as a focal point of devotion, mm-hmm. in the same way that any altar, any statue or religious work of art does so without the need for supernatural occurrences or ancient, technological devices or weird traps or what have you. No bells and whistles required. I also can't help but compare it to the notion of a focal point or a drishti in yoga.
Hmm.
And this is where you're not even looking necessarily at anything in particular. Maybe you're looking at a line on the wall, mm-hmm. or just a point in space, and you're focusing your attention on that. And in doing so, hopefully entering some sort of meditative state.
Right. The goal is to center consciousness, to crowd out other thoughts entering.
Right. And I imagine a lot of our listeners out there, you've had that experience either by focusing on nothing, focusing on, say, a clock on a wall or a wall socket, or perhaps some bit of religious art, an altarpiece, a cross, what have you, various Hindu iconography as well. Like, these can serve as just a way to focus our mind and also think about perhaps what is illustrated in the work itself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, all ultimately very much a form of induction or a formally ritualized procedure whose function is the narrowing of consciousness by focusing attention. I also can't help but think that with a golden item like the Ark, mm-hmm. so you have the Ark, it's covered in gold.
Right.
You have it in a dark pavilion. And what kind of illumination do you have around you?
Well, you might have burning sacrifices. So mm-hmm. there, indoors, you generally probably have firelight, but mm-hmm. you could also have a sacrifice burning at the altar that would be a sort of like a fire there. And I have to think also that there would generally be smoke in this environment. You'd be burning something in censers.
So you probably have smoke. You have some firelight of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
You have this gleaming golden artifact, not even getting into the cherubim that are on it. But it seems like that the light would play off of it in curious ways. The smoke would add to the mystique.
It sounds like an environment that is generous to the creation of altered states of consciousness.
Exactly. Again, with no drugs or magical interpretations required.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I know some of you out there that have listened to the show for a while are probably thinking at this point, well, what about the bicameral mind?
Right, yeah.
Because clearly this whole time we've been talking about a way of speaking to God, a way of hearing God's voice, right? So it seems like it would naturally be a part of all that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, let's just refresh about the bicameral mind and the idea of bicameral hallucinations. In The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, the late Julian Jaynes argued that ancient humans heard hallucinated voices and that human consciousness as we know it today began roughly 3,000 years ago as a cultural invention, which of course would kind of line up with the
the time frame that we're talking about here with the Ark. Mm-hmm. It's an unproven hypothesis, and we've discussed some objections to it in past episodes, but it remains possible that at least some aspect of it is correct. In a way, it's a very safe kind of idea for Janes to have proposed because there was and remains no real way of proving or disproving it.
Right. You can't prove it because it's in history, but I do think it's subject to undermining by evidence.
Yes.
I mean, like one of the things that I think would help undermine it is if you can just find more and more ancient examples of people demonstrating inner consciousness in ancient literature.
Right.
I mean, like he pointed to some examples of ancient literature and said, oh, they're remarkably devoid of the idea of an inner voice or inner thoughts. So I think one pretty easy way of saying, no, he was probably wrong, is just to look at ancient texts that do show signs of consciousness and inner monologue.
And then also he was very open about the fact that he basically just looked at Western and classical examples, classical literature, classical architecture for evidence of the bicameral mind. He didn't really look at Eastern examples because he did not speak the language.
Now, you mentioned, and we've said this before, that it's one of these ideas that is probably wrong but really interesting and could be correct in some ways, mm-hmm. like some sub-parts of the hypothesis could have something to them. I think that I've been convinced that Janes is probably wrong about his model of consciousness, where consciousness came from and all that. Very likely wrong there, but could very well be right about the idea that ancient religions involved much more visions and hallucinations than modern religions do. I think that that's entirely plausible, and there's a lot of about reading, at least about ancient religious practices, that seems to indicate that that maybe is true.
Yeah, because there is a lot of listening to the voices of the gods, seeking the voices of the gods, and we still see it reflected in our in hymns and prayers that are said every day, asking to hear some voice, even though we do not hear the voice. The voice does not actually speak to us in our minds.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think even if the main part of his hypothesis, the idea of the development of consciousness in these different stages, if that's completely wrong, he could have been on the right track looking at all these ancient examples of the almost ubiquitous religious visions and hallucinations in ancient worship.
Right. Now, Janes's ultimate argument was that modern consciousness was a learned development tied to metaphorical language. And that this change wouldn't have occurred all at once then. It would have been something that spread.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have affected like everybody within a given town at once. It wouldn't be like everybody, oh, you got the new consciousness shot. All right, we're all good to go. You would have had a lot of confusion, a lot of a bit of chaos. The voices of the gods, they grow fainter, but then they can be reached again via various practices.
Like essentially it was becoming harder to hallucinate.
Right. Now, Janes did mention the Ark specifically in his original book. He said, quote, "Poetry then was divine knowledge, and after the breakdown of the bicameral mind, poetry was the sound and tenor of authorization. Poetry commanded where prose could only ask. It felt good. In the wanderings of the Hebrews after the exodus from Egypt, it was the sacred shrine that was carried before the multitude and followed by the people. But it was also the poetry of Moses that determined when they would start and when stop, where they would go and where stay." And this is, of course, referring to the fact that Moses would speak to through the Ark. It authorized his decision-making. So Janes didn't really get into the Ark all that much in the book or in other papers of his that I've seen. It's possible I'm missing something because I haven't read everything that Janes wrote. But I did run across some writings by Brian J. McVeigh, a scholar of Asia specializing in Japan. And he also studied under Julian Janes as a graduate student. And he discussed this a bit in his paper, Biblical Evidence of Bicameral Mentality, Vestiges of Super Religiosity in the Old Testament.
Hmm.
He discussed how the Ark could have functioned as an object of hallucinatory focus, or OHF, and a portable one at that, for the ancient Hebrews as they wandered the desert and wandered out of the bicameral mindset. So this is his quote from the paper where he's describing what an OHF is. Quote, hallucinatory aids broadcast instructions, commandments, warnings. Speaking idols, living statues, effigies treated as if alive, fed, paraded, taken on journeys and into battles. These emitted holy power and authorized decision-making. In some cases, portable OHF were used, an example being the Israelites' Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, again, as I said a minute ago, you don't really have to accept the bicameral framework for consciousness and the origin of these hallucinations in order to think, well, maybe that there are just physical objects that aid the mind in having religious visions or religious experiences, much in the same like in the example of induction, like we were talking about earlier, with the object of focus in, say, Hindu or Buddhist meditation.
Yeah, exactly. The bicameral explanation is fascinating as it is. It's not completely necessary for understanding why individuals would carry around a sacred item, carry it into battle, and also use it in their rituals.
Isn't it so interesting the way religions around the world, so many of them have what you might call scene setting? All these, all this paraphernalia, like different clothing, different sights and smells, physical objects to hold or be in the presence of, to look at, smoke, washing of the body, like all these different things that are in order to get you into a different mind state than you are the rest of your life. You're out walking around, getting your groceries, going to work, doing your stuff. But when you enter a religious space, you have to go through a process and surround yourself with things that put you in a different state of mind. And this seems to be core to not every version of religion around the world, but a whole lot of them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if it's not a particular icon or representation, because certainly there are religions that that frown upon that, depicting individuals or deities, et cetera.
Yeah.
There still is often like a focus on architecture or space.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Like in Islam, you're generally not going to have representative art, but you do have a lot of attention to the creation of a sacred feeling environment. The interior architecture of many mosques around the world is beautiful, and it puts you in a different mind state.
All right. Well, hopefully we've put everybody in a different mind state today as we discussed the Ark of the Covenant. And hey, here's the fun part. We're not done. There's going to be another episode on the Ark of the Covenant looking at a particular idea, the idea that, okay, what if the Ark of the Covenant was a machine?
I'm going to give a spoiler. We don't think it was a machine, but that does lead us down some other interesting paths that that'll be a lot of fun to explore.
Right. In the meantime, you can check out all the episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find them all. That's where you'll find links out to our social media accounts, including that discussion module page that I mentioned earlier. Obviously, we'd love to hear from everybody about the Ark of the Covenant, your thoughts on it, crazy theories you've read about it, your thoughts on Raiders of the Lost Ark. All of it is fair game.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to say hi, let us know where you listen from, to suggest a topic for the future, you can always do that at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.